Today on Earth Eats Pickling 101 with Chef Daniel Orr. Grab some vegetables. Any vegetables will do. I'm Annie Corrigan. Also from Harvest Public Media, water contamination in Flint, Michigan put a spotlight on drinking water safety. Other Midwestern cities are dealing with a different kind of pollution.
The soil plant water system is not an engineered system. It's a natural system, a natural ecosystem that the growers are trying to manage.
Nitrates are ending up in our water. That's part one of a special series called Watching Our Water. Then we have a profile of kettle corn producer Chris Vosters. Mark Chilla, can we get some news?
The World Health Organization, the UN, and the World Bank have called superbugs a fundamental threat to global security. Superbug refers to strains of various types of bacteria, such as E. coli, that are resistant to antibiotic drugs. Now, researchers at George Washington University's Antibiotic Resistance Action Center are saying they found a new strain of MRSA, or methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, in people in Denmark transmitted through consumption of infected poultry. Previous research also showed MRSA to be present in pork, beef, and dairy products, though transmissions through food have been rare. Until this study, researchers mostly thought superbugs spread to farmers, veterinarians, or other people who work closely with food production animals given antibiotics, not through direct consumption of antibiotic meat productions. The release of the research is well-timed, as the UN General Assembly held a high-level summit on drug-resistant bacteria this week, only the fourth time this type of meeting has happened for a health issue. The Environmental Protection Agency has issued a report concluding that the herbicide glyphosate is not likely to cause cancer in humans. The report is part of a lengthy process by which the EPA is reviewing many agricultural chemicals and deciding whether farmers will be allowed to use them. As NPR's Dan Charles reports, these findings echo reports by the European Food Safety Agency and the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization. European regulators, meanwhile, are locked in a political battle over whether glyphosate use will continue to be permitted on that continent. The European Commission has authorized continued sales of the chemical, but only temporarily. Supporters and opponents of several proposed mergers among agricultural seed and chemical companies are making their case to lawmakers in Washington. The U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing this week to, as Committee Chairman Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa put it, get everything out on the table. Grassley says public testimony can raise concerns the Department of Justice and Federal Trade Commission may need to consider as they evaluate the proposed new pairings. It's up to the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission to decide how or whether the deals go through. DuPont would merge with Dow, Monsanto has announced Bayer will buy it, and a Chinese state-owned chemical company plans to buy Syngenta. And in Manhattan, halal street carts have become ubiquitous. Chicago just opened its third Eat-In Halal Guys franchise, and nationally, Whole Foods says halal foods are one of its fastest-growing categories. Rising popularity has turned halal foods into a $1.9 billion per year business at grocery stores in the U.S., according to Nielsen figures. According to an organization that certifies halal food, the Islamic Food and Nutrition Council of America, the figure is more like $20 billion per year if you include restaurants. The council says that marks a 30% increase since 2010. Frozen halal meal maker Saffron Road told Bloomberg that 80% of their consumers are buying for quality, not trying to follow Islamic law. Like with kosher foods, halal rules require humane treatment of animals during slaughter, as well as oversight from religious officials.
If you want more food news stories, a good place to start is with our Twitter. You can find a compilation of news sources by browsing our lists. Connect with us at Earth Eats. Mark is here every week, and we're grateful for it.
You're the real hero, Annie.
Contaminated drinking water isn't just a problem for Flint, Michigan. Many towns and cities across the Midwest and Great Plains face pollution seeping into their water supplies. A big part of the problem? Farming and ranching. Luke Runyon has more as part of Harvest Public Media's special series, Watching Our Water.
I am here on the banks of the South Platte River up near Bailey, Colorado. Just took my shoes off. I'm actually going to wade into the river. Ooh, okay, it is cold. This water that I'm standing in filters down from the mountains, crisp and cool, and someday it's going to empty into the Gulf of Mexico. And while it makes its journey, it picks up some pretty nasty stuff. And that's causing a bunch of problems for fish in the Gulf and people in farm country. I'm going to get out of here. My feet are completely numb. Rivers like this one pick up potentially dangerous levels of nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus. In high concentrations, they damage aquatic life and burden small towns that have to remove them. It's happening across the Mississippi watershed, which stretches from Pennsylvania to Colorado to Louisiana. And it's making the news.
When you see these signs, they're alarming. These warnings about the water, they're posted all over Burlington. And this is
scientists who work for the federal government have discovered a huge dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
A water warning for people living in the village of Erie, Illinois. Testing found high levels of nitrate.
One of the biggest concerns when it comes to water quality in our area is nitrate.
So nutrients are ending up concentrated in our water. But how?
So there's actually quite a few ways that nutrients or nitrogen compounds can end up in drinking water.
That's Andrew Ross, a water quality scientist with the Colorado Department of Public Health. He says sources include everything from natural deposits to the atmosphere to one really big one, human activities.
So that could be from sewage treatment systems, septic systems at homes, fertilizers on lawns, fertilizers in farms, livestock management.
Those last two, crop farms and livestock operations, are the biggest contributors to nutrient problems in the Gulf of Mexico. Nitrogen is plant food. Farmers spread it in the form of fertilizer to grow profitable crops. A 2008 study from scientists at the U.S. Geological Survey found that corn and soybean farming in the Mississippi River watershed is the largest contributor of nitrogen to the Gulf. Manure from livestock grazing on pasture is the biggest source of phosphorus.
It's really not a simple problem. It's a relatively complex problem.
Troy Bowder studies water quality at Colorado State University. He ends up talking to a lot of farmers about how to keep the fertilizer they put in their fields from ending up in streams or in groundwater. It isn't easy.
The soil plant water system is not an engineered system. It's a natural system, a natural ecosystem that the growers are trying to manage.
Farmers don't want to be causing pollution problems in the Gulf or in the rivers that cities depend on. And being less than careful is expensive.
There's definitely incentive for them not to apply too much or at the wrong time because they want maximum uptake of those nutrients into their crop production.
What makes it tough to control is that it's not just the actions of one farmer. It's the collective actions of tens of thousands of farmers affecting water quality. So far, no national regulations have been able to take into account the vast number of pollution sources and varied geography in the Mississippi watershed. But there are signs of hope. For a long time, Bowder says farmers were resistant to hearing about the problem and their contributions to it. Knowing about it would mean having to carry the burden of fixing it. But he says that attitude is changing, and that attitude shift could be what it takes to help keep drinking water safe. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Next week, what farmers are doing to cut nitrate pollution. The series Watching Our Water is also at harvestpublicmedia.org. When your garden is as massive as Daniel Orr's, you have no choice but to get good at preserving food. We visited him a day after he went on a pickling spree.
Yeah, well, we've got to, I thinned all of my rows yesterday. So I went out there and I pulled all the baby beets. I've got two kinds of baby long carrots, the red ones and the regular ones. I've got some red onions. And these are little round ones that you could drop into a martini or serve with some beet salad or some goat cheese.
The mason jars are full of red and pink and orange veggies. He saved the green beans for us to demonstrate how easy it is to preserve foods.
All right, today on Earth Eats, we're going to do the quick pickle.
Starting with the brine.
All right, we're going to take about 2 cups of standard white vinegar. We're going to add a bit of salt. Okay, we're also going to add some sugar. All right, and then now is the time where you kind of decide what kind of flavor you want to bring out. I love a little bit of red pepper flakes. All right, and then I'm going to run out onto the porch, and that's where we keep some of our spices. I'm going to grab some star anise and some cinnamon to go in this. Hey, and I found a few other things while I was out there that were going to be
fun. You always come back with more than what you say you're going to.
All right, and so this is where, you know, pickling is fun, and really do have fun with things. I've got the cinnamon stick 2.5 inches long. I'm breaking that up to release the essential oils. I'm going to add star anise. Okay, it's got that real nice licorice-y flavor. All right, we've got some mustard seed, about a teaspoon. I've got some homegrown coriander seeds from last year's coriander plants. And then finally, a little bit of clove. I'm going to add a little bit of garlic as well. All right. So we're going to bring that to a boil. We're going to stir that so the sugar dissolves in there. While that is happening, I had an empty jar around here someplace.
This guy?
Yeah, there it is. Hiding behind the spices. All right, so I've got a ball jar. What we've done is we've blanched some green beans. We're just going to kind of cram all the green beans down into that. All right, so that pickling brine has come to a boil, and while it's still hot, we're going to ladle it over those beans. And the acidity in the vinegar is a natural preservative. So, you know, you can leave these out, you know, a few days, but if you're going to keep them a long time, it's best to keep them in the fridge. All right, so you put the lid on. Okay, quick little shake. Disperse all those seeds and garlic. And so those are Quick Pickles 101.
I say store these in the fridge. A cold green bean pickle is even better. These beans won't actually stay a bright, vibrant green, so you know. The vinegar is going to zap them of their color, which is why Daniel also wanted to give you this recipe. No lemon juice on our ingredient list, but yes, lemon zest, which gives the snow pea and tomato salad a bright flavor without compromising the beautiful color.
So basically what we've done is we've taken some Roma tomatoes, and we've cut them into quarters, and then we toss them with a little bit of olive oil, garlic, salt, and pepper. And then we put them under the broiler and let them get nice and caramelized. And you can see, you know, there's some nice dark caramelization on them. The other part of this salad are some wonderful snow peas. These are some that my friend Kevin Baker brought me over from his garden. They almost look like lima beans. They're getting that big. It's kind of the end of the season for the snow peas. But I've blanched them in salted water, then shocked them in ice water like we do so often. Okay, so we've got 4 cups of pea pods, and we've got 3 cups of roasted tomatoes. Okay, and we're going to add a little bit of olive oil. We're going to add about a tablespoon of chopped garlic, teaspoon of lemon zest, and then guess what? A whole handful of herbs. So basil, mint, cilantro, chervil, scallions, whatever you have. You're just going to rough cut it because we want every bite to be a little different. We've got all those ingredients together. Toss them around. The only thing we need to add is a little salt and pepper to taste. And see, we're not making a traditional salad that has a lot of vinegar or acid in it because we want these pea pods to stay looking nice and green. And if we added lemon juice or vinegar, they'd look like someone's army fatigues. So we don't want that to happen. So, this just is enrobed in the olive oil with that, slight acidity from the roasted tomatoes. And that's really all you need. And it's a delicious salad.
We post all of Daniel Orr's recipes on our website. You know what else we have online? Recipes for pumpkin sage pasta and zucchini noodles. Nice. EarthEats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated. Now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb, taste matters, your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Meatpacking plants dot the Midwest and offer a decent paycheck to people without strong English skills. That means that the plants draw refugees and immigrants to towns that haven't hosted particularly diverse populations in the past. For Harvest Public Media, Ponce Rutch brings us this story of students with many diverse backgrounds coming together.
Fort Morgan is a town in northeastern Colorado with a population of about 11,000.
And actually, our little town, it's an anomaly. We have all these people from other places in the world, and we have one thing in common is soccer.
That's Nick Ng. He runs a cafe, teaches art, and coaches both the boys and girls soccer teams at Fort Morgan High School, the Mustangs.
But out of curiosity, even for myself, just shout out like your different countries that you're from. Even, I know we got some Fort Morgan, just
Guatemala,
El Salvador,
Mexico,
Kenya,
Kenya, Kenya. Somalia. Africa. Which country? Not country.
Africa's a big
country.
Hey, this guy's Russian.
Ukraine. Sergey's Ukraine.
Many of the Mustangs have grown up here, but few call themselves Caucasian. People of Latino ancestry have lived in Fort Morgan for decades. And in 2006, a wave of refugees from Eastern Africa brought the population from 0% African American to somewhere between 6 and 10%. That kind of population change is common in meatpacking towns from Postville, Iowa, to Lexington, Nebraska, to Roseville, Illinois.
Where I come? Well, 'cause soccer's life.
James Lara and his best friend Eddie, or Heriberto Munoz, are both sophomores and identify as Hispanic. And waiting next to Eddie and James is Dwali Abdi.
I have a passion because I want to be professional, you know. And my dad used to play soccer, though. Yeah. No, he's not here, though. He's in Africa right now.
Abdi has lived in Fort Morgan for 3 years. Before that, he lived in Cleveland. And before that, Somalia. He sends his father photos of his soccer games.
He's saying like that. Keep doing, you know, what you're doing, you know.
Coach Ng says the makeup of his team gives them a scrappy dynamic when they're on the field, but it's also led to some unwanted tensions during games.
We all play some schools that don't have the diversity we have, and yes, things are said on the field.
Ng and his assistant coach, Juan Anguiano, have heard their share of slurs.
If the referee doesn't hear you, it's totally legal, and all we do, hey, just keep it cool, it's part of the game, do the right thing.
They report the really hurtful incidents, but the truth is that those players are outside of their control. So they focus on what they can control, the cohesion of the Fort Morgan Mustangs. This isn't always easy.
What you might see is that when the kids arrive, they do sit separately.
There are a few clusters of Latino kids and a few clusters of African kids lacing up their cleats before practice. The Lone Rangers, like the kid from Ukraine, get absorbed into other groups. But otherwise, the team looks like how I remember my school cafeteria, with different cliques loosely based on ethnicity or neighborhood.
I need to incorporate some strategies to get them to mingle more.
Some of those strategies are a typical part of building a team. For example, if Coach Ng hears a swear word, he and all 50 or so guys at practice drop to the ground and start doing crunches.
Don't get comfortable. You always have to be trying 110%.
And they do a lot of crunches. James Lara says that by the end of last season, he had six-pack abs.
Over the summer, I got fat. So I only have half of four packs.
And for every kid who's late, the whole team has to run a stride, meaning that they run to the half line and then sprint to the opposite goalpost.
All the way! Cross the line!
They run drills together, they pass to each other, and who knows which players will be waiting for you on the sidelines to join the scrimmage. Plus, it's only the beginning of the season, and Coach Ng says some of the team are still just learning each other's names.
What I do at the end of practice, we do hands around. So everyone's shaking hands, introducing themselves over and over again, so that we get to know each other's names.
Only when each of the players touches three other players' hands can they go home. And if they know everyone's name, they still have to touch hands and say, good game or nice play, something to show sportsmanship.
I do need to do whatever I can to break down some of those barriers. It's a comfort zone. It's a comfort zone.
Next, Coach Ng is thinking of getting the kids to draw a teammate's name out of a hat and eat lunch with that person all week. Sounds a bit like the movie Remember the Titans. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Ponce Rutch.
That story was originally produced by KUNC in Colorado. A visit now to the farmer's market. Vendor and farmer Chris Vosters sells kettle corn at the market every Saturday morning. As Chris tells student producer Kale Wilk, her business has been the one constant throughout a life of changes.
That's the sound of kettle corn popping. It's like popcorn, except the kernels are popped in an oiled kettle and given sugar rather than salt. Right now, we're at a place that some might say is pretty poppin' itself, the Bloomington, Indiana Farmers Market.
Be careful, it's hot yet?
That's Chris Vosters. She's a 56-year-old kettle corn farmer north of Odin, Indiana.
I was daddy's boy. They had no other boy, so I grew up doing the farming thing. It's always been my background. It's been my passion.
When the season comes around, Chris looks forward to her weekend trips to Bloomington. She puts on an old dress and apron that makes her look like someone from the early 20th century. Kettle corn has some of its roots during the Great Depression when sugar was rationed. While her son-in-law Steve cooks the corn in the back of their booth, Chris sells it up front.
Don't have that hot.
Be careful, it's hot, yeah?
I eat hot.
You do?
All right,
just don't want you to get burnt, buddy. Well, I put on that old dress, I can be anything. You know, they don't know who I am or what I am. I can be anybody. I tried to treat everybody the same. And that's what's so neat about it, because I deal with them all, you know, from professors up there at IU to doctors to lawyers to the guy that works for the Walmart or the guy that flips cheeseburgers. I mean, all of them's my customers, and especially market. You know, a lot of people, I don't know the name, but I know the face and what they like and what they don't like. And it's more of a relationship with them.
She inherited the farm and business from her parents. But the family business wasn't always kettle corn. It started as cornmeal and livestock. And then someone gave her parents and husband a playful suggestion.
My parents went to Florida in the wintertime.
It was 1998.
And there was a family they met at the Florida State Fair that had a kettle corn operation.
They were the Brunkies from Missouri.
This man, he was always trying to sell my husband a kettle corn operation. You know, he was trying to market him a kettle and first one thing and then two. And
Brunke shows them how to do it as long as they stay out of a local show and out of Missouri.
So my husband came home and him and my dad welded up the first winter and, you know, just kind of a dare challenge thing. And
so they play around with the kettle corn rig, serve some people at a local show, and decide,
This is a way that we can make this go. This is the way we can specialize for the family farm. So basically that's how we got into it. It was a dare to build a kettle amongst two friends, and it never intended to grow into what it is today.
And today it's a family tradition. I asked Chris to show me around her farm to see all that was there.
That's a combine in there. And the grain platform.
There's her house, her daughter's house, and two main sheds with farming vehicles and equipment.
And then what is this over here that we're walking up to?
This is the original family farm. The house was built in 1875. It was homesteaded then. My parents bought it in 1958. This is where I grew up.
Chris sometimes receives help from family, but...
I'm pretty much a loner. It's just me. I take care of one person, that's me. And the dog, of course. That's a dog. Yeah, she's a good dog. She's a best friend, aren't you, Autumn? Speak. Can you speak? Can you say something? Can you speak?
Oh my goodness.
There are fewer people on the farm these days. Chris's father died in 2002. Her husband died in 2010. Then her mother died 2 years ago.
You want your parents to live in long, healthy, happy life, and your husband and the whole nine yards, but that's not the card I got dealt. I got dealt a three, and if I got dealt a three, I can't play an ace or a king. So I just deal with it. I wish they were all here, and I'm sure that everybody's lost anybody. They feel the same way. So go on. If I went back and sat in that house and sat in that chair, I'd die. So that's how I deal with all the death, all the sadness, all the things is keep busy, because when I'm working, I'm not thinking.
Chris's work helps her pay the bills. It even helped get her kids through college. But they've all moved on with their lives. For Chris, this is her way of life. On the farm, she can't escape the memories of her loved ones. They inform everything she does.
Live like you're dying, because you are. You just don't realize it. And I try to do something fun every day. Just a little bit. Something I want to do. Don't put off things that you want to do for tomorrow, because there may not be one.
Would you have rather had it any other way?
No. No, when my husband retired, he told me, he says, I got one move. I'll take you anywhere in the world you want to go. You want the Bahamas, you want Antigua, you want California. I said, you just take me on home till daddy dies. I said, I felt obligated to be here with my parents. My dad had heart trouble. He wasn't doing well. So we came home. And when he died in 02, I asked my husband, I said, now do you want to go somewhere else? And he said, nope. He said, we're just fine right here. So I wouldn't live any different.
And that means cooking more kettle corn. I asked Chris how long she expects to keep doing it.
How long am I going to cook corn? Till I can't cook corn no more.
What exactly does that mean?
Oh, I don't know. As long as I'm physically able, strong enough to do it, I'll do it. You know, what else am I going to do? I can get a real job. Do I really want a real job? Probably not. So as long as I'm physically able to do it, I'll probably cook a little corn.
For Earth Eats, I'm Cale Wilk.
See a picture of Chris Vosters serving up kettle corn at eartheats.org. Our great team of workers at Earth Eats includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, and the wonderful folks at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. And from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And the best support of all is from you tuning in every week. Thanks for being here. I'm Annie Corrigan.